www.asu.edu.
This is the Daily Circuit. I'm Carrie Miller along with Tom Weber. This hour, the science of monster tornadoes, and then my conversation with Temple Grandin about the neuroscience of autism.
Carrie, leading the regional news here, obviously we're still looking at what lawmakers did here last night as they approached their midnight deadline to pass a budget. One thing they did not do was finalize legislation to increase the minimum wage in Minnesota. House and Senate DFLers could not reach an agreement on a new base wage. Lawmakers did, though, approve and send to the governor a pared-down public works construction bill. DFL legislative leaders cut a deal with their Republican counterparts for a $156 million bonding bill that continues the restoration of the state capitol building. It also provides flood mitigation to northwest Minnesota and funds at a Minneapolis veterans home. Supporters say it funds the immediate needs of the state. DFL Representative Carlos Mariani of St. Paul supported the bill but said he wished it had spent more.
I think it's a fine bill. I've been a supporter of the Capitol. I absolutely agree with you. We cannot afford to lose this facility. This is a Minnesota gem. What concerns me is what's not in this bill.
The measure was scaled back after the House failed to get the needed votes to pass an $800 million bonding bill. The new bill overwhelmingly passed the both House and Senate. A spokeswoman for the governor says Governor Dayton will sign it. Richfield-based Best Buy posted an $81 million first quarter net loss as the company lowered prices to compete with online rivals. In the same quarter a year ago, the consumer electronics retailer had net income of $158 million. Excluding restructuring and some other charges, though, the company actually exceeded Wall Street expectations, but the retailer warned that continued price competition could squeeze profits in coming months. The city of Moorhead is considering getting out of the sandbag business. City manager Michael Redlinger says the city spent nearly $500,000 preparing for potential flooding for this spring, and most of that was for 50,000 sandbags for some 87 homes still left on the Red River. Some city leaders tell the Fargo Forum that's too much money to spend on too few people. Mayor Mark Voxland said paying for sandbags should fall to homeowners who have declined buyouts. The city council discussed the issue at its meeting yesterday. And Carrie, that is the latest regional news here on the Daily Circuit.
Tom, while recovery crews are working amid the devastation in Moore, Oklahoma, the threat for tornadoes today is shifting into southwestern Arkansas and parts of Texas. Today, we're going to talk about the science of large tornadoes and what meteorologists understand about the way they behave. If you've ever witnessed a significantly large tornado, many of us have. What's the most unusual thing you've ever observed about the way they act? Now, we're kind of at the northern end of Tornado Alley here, but plenty of us have seen tornadoes. Ever seen a large one? Ever notice something unusual about the way they behave? Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. You can also post your comments on my Twitter feed, at @CarrieMPR. Karen Kosiba is an atmospheric scientist at the Center for Severe Weather Research in Boulder, Colorado. She is in Oklahoma this morning. Karen, thanks so much for the time. It's good to have you here.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Jeff Masters is a meteorologist and co-founder of the Weather Underground, and he's with us from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Jeff, I've been reading your blog this morning, so I'm really grateful that you had time for us today.
Thank you, Terry. I just made a new post before we got on the air.
All right. We'll tweet that out. Karen, the storm stretched all the way from Texas up to Minnesota yesterday. I mean, we had some of the residual rain and thunder showers. Here's what I want to know. Why do those storms behave the way they do in where you are and behave differently in somewhere like Minnesota? Why is that?
Well, yesterday was a particularly well-forecast situation. So in Oklahoma, really all the ingredients were coming together with the system moving through. There was a lot of shear in the atmosphere. There was a lot of instability. And there was a lot of forcing to get these storms going. And really those conditions were ripe all along central Oklahoma.
So when you say instability, what do we hear meteorologists use that word a lot. What's it really mean?
What that really means is that there's a lot of energy in the atmosphere. So as parcels rise in the atmosphere, as you get surface parcels rising up, really what happens is you get a lot of vigorous convection going on. There's a lot of energy there, a lot of energy to be released. So these parcels cool pretty rapidly as they rise up, and they're able to release a lot of this energy. So that's what we're referring to when we're talking about instability in the atmosphere. The atmospheric profile is ripe for these parcels to rise and release this type of energy.
Jeff, and when we say energy, do we mean what happens when a cold front, a warm front comes together, and the different kind of molecules that they create in the atmosphere. I really want to dig down here on how this works.
Right. It's a complicated process. In order to get thunderstorms, in order to get particularly devastating thunderstorms like these supercell thunderstorms, energy-wise, what has to happen is that you usually have to have a very moist, warm sort of surface air mass. But then as you go up higher in the atmosphere, certain parts of the atmosphere becomes less moist and less warm. And what happens then is this warm, moist air is rising. It's able to condense and make these big clouds and make these big thunderstorms and fuel these thunderstorms, basically.
Okay. Jeff, what can you add to that?
Yeah, she's got it pretty nailed. I mean, this time of year, May, is when we expect to see these sorts of weather conditions. And Oklahoma and the surrounding states is called Tornado Alley for good reason. There's no place else on Earth where you get exactly the right sort of ingredients like we saw yesterday and are seeing again today.
Jeff, I noticed that the meteorologist in Oklahoma City were noting that at times the clouds were boiling up over the funnels of these tornadoes and obscuring it. And they were also calling some of these tornadoes wedge tornadoes. What is that?
The clouds that they were talking about, they might be two things. One is debris. I mean, when this tornado started chopping through the neighborhoods and more, it threw a tremendous amount of debris in the air and obscured the actual funnel that you can see. And the wedge shape is exactly what you would think. I mean, it's a kind of a trapezoid-shaped tornado, wider at the top near where the cloud is, and then not quite as wide at the bottom where it's mowing along the ground. And this tornado didn't have kind of the classic Wizard of Oz look to it. It was just too wide. It was kind of this big wedge that was wedged underneath the supercell thunderstorm mowing along Moore, Oklahoma.
How unusual are wedge tornadoes?
You see them fairly often this time of year in the Midwest. I mean, when you get a big tornado that's at least a half mile wide, oftentimes it takes this wedge shape.
Mm-hmm. And Karen, I'm sure you're there looking at the damage firsthand. Are you seeing, I mean, you're seeing the consequences, right, of a wedge tornado, one that is shaped like that?
Right. Actually, we're leaving Oklahoma today. We're headed down to Texas because the weather conditions are favorable in Texas for another type of event. But certainly watching the news, and I've damage surveys, tornadoes of this significance, the damage is just devastating and devastating to the town of Moore. I mean, there's certainly a lot of high-end damage to structures down there.
Are you out there to really follow the weather patterns?
Well, what we're all here to do is we're actually out with a few of our radar trucks and a few of our other vehicles. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to map out the winds in these tornadoes. So we're trying to map them out with radar, but then we're also trying to map them out with in-situ instrumentation. So pieces of instrumentation that we try to place in the path of the tornado.
Wow. What do you learn from that?
Well, there's several things we're trying to learn. In particular, with this mission that we're doing, is we're trying to understand what the low-level structure is like in the tornado, what the winds are doing in the lowest level, because those are the winds that cause damage to different structures. So we're trying to map out those winds and see how strong they are, how they change with height, and how they change with time.
Jeff, are there things that you don't understand about tornadoes?
Yeah, I mean, they're one of the least understood meteorological phenomena that we deal with, in part because they're so rare, and in part because they're really hard to measure. I mean, you try and put a weather tower in front of a tornado, and the tornado destroys it. So even our models aren't that good either, because a lot of what happens in a tornado that makes it tick occurs on really small scales, on the order of hundreds of meters. And our computer models that look at the atmosphere tend to try and chop up the atmosphere into little grid cells that are maybe, 5 kilometers on a side at best. So a lot of problems with trying to understand tornadoes.
This is going to sound like kind of a simple question, Jeff, but what makes a tornado spin so fast that it can, sweep up and carry extremely heavy, tons worth of debris? I mean, what contributes to a tornado that it has that kind of power?
Yeah, there's a couple sources of energy, and Karen touched on one where you've got a lot of instability in the atmosphere where you get these strongly rising updrafts. And the speed of the air rising in those updrafts, I mean, it can get close to 100 miles per hour, but you need something to tilt those updrafts and get them spinning. And the thing that does that are the winds of the jet stream. The jet stream is that high altitude river of air that flows at altitudes of, 20 or 30,000 feet above the ground. And if you've got a strong jet stream blowing on the order of, 50 to 100 miles per hour, those winds can get the updrafts of a thunderstorm spinning at very high speeds in excess of 100 miles per hour.
Karen, the other thing I was curious about is it was noted that this tornado yesterday stayed on the ground for such a long period of time, which is why it did so much damage. What happens when a tornado is able to stay on the ground for so long? I mean, what's happening inside the tornado?
Right. I mean, those are some of the questions that we're really trying to answer. We had this big field project a few years back. It was called Vortex 2 in 2009 and 2010 that the National Science Foundation was funding. And what we were trying to do is we were trying to answer those types of questions. We're trying to understand better how tornadoes form, but then once they form, how they go on to intensify and stay on the ground, not for, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, but as in the case of the Moore, Oklahoma, 30 plus minutes.
Wow.
We still don't know what causes that. The conditions usually are ripe for supporting a tornado for that long period of time. So it keeps moving into an atmosphere where the shear is good, where the low-level shear is good, so the winds are supporting that, and the moisture is good. So it keeps moving, presumably, into an atmosphere supportive of tornadoes.
Hey, Karen, it sounds like your technology to do this kind of measuring is getting better. Is that true?
It is getting better. It's getting a lot better. There's been, a big push. Computers have gotten a lot better. Jeff was talking about computer models in the last 10 or so years with increasing computational power. We're able to model things on smaller and smaller scales. Also observing. There's a lot of mobile radars and observing systems out there, UAVs, unmanned aerial vehicles, that could really target areas of the storm that we don't know much about and we really think are key to how tornadoes form and how tornadoes go on to strengthen.
Jeff, there has already been discussion about the fact that this tornado followed the path of two other tornadoes, and CNN kind of laid one over the other last night. Is that just coincidence? What is that, weather conditions? What is that? Why would these tornadoes follow such a similar path?
It's interesting. When you look at a map of where strong tornadoes tend to occur this time of year, there's a bullseye right over south central Oklahoma, right over Moore, as it turns out. And it just turns out that that's the part of the country where you just happen to get, you're in the sweet spot. You're the right distance from the Gulf of Mexico to get the warm, moist air there. You're the right distance from Canada to get the cold, dry air aloft that you need to cause instability. And you're the right distance from the desert southwest where you can get a flow of dry air that acts as kind of a cap on the storm that keeps things bottled up until energy builds up to the point where it just boils over into the kind of supercells we saw yesterday.
Oh, that's interesting. I had no idea that it was really that the distance from the Gulf and all the other ingredients that you talk about that put more right in exactly the right place.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at a 50-year climatology, it's really striking how sharply the tornado frequency falls off as you go away from Moore.
Karen, what's it looking like here for Texas and Arkansas today?
Well, similar type situation setting up for Texas and Arkansas. What it looks like here is that actually the storms are going to organize very quickly and form something that we call a QCLS, or kind of a quasi-linear convective system. And in that case, a lot of the storms interact with each other and you don't get too many rotating thunderstorms. But before that forms, you have the potential to get tornadoes. You have the potential to get these discrete supercell thunderstorms. So there probably will be a brief time that the atmosphere will support supercells and potentially tornadoes.
So be safe out there, Karen, and thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Jeff, thank you for the time. Really appreciate it. We'll post your blog.
Okay, thanks, Terry.
Really appreciate it. That's the latest on the tornado news, and we'll keep an eye on it through the hour. My conversation with Temple Grandin coming next, but a look at the news.
Hi, Carrie. An effort to split the job of CEO and chairman at J.P. Morgan Chase has failed. Jamie Dimon will keep both jobs after a shareholders' vote this morning. 32% of shareholders voted for the plan, though. It would have required the bank to split the roles. If it had passed, Dimon would have had to relinquish the role of chairman. Shareholder groups lobbying for the split gained momentum from last year's surprise $6 billion trading loss, which tarnished the reputation of both the company and Dimon. The bank and Dimon had argued that letting him keep both jobs was the most effective form of leadership. Iranian news websites have boosted speculation that election overseers have barred two prominent but divisive figures from next month's presidential ballot in Iran. The hardliner website TasmanNews.com says the Guardian Council has rejected former President Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani and Afsaran Rahi Mashai, a close confidant of outgoing President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. The reports are not official. The announcement on the list for the June 14th election is expected later today or tomorrow. The Guardian Council vets all election hopefuls. Coming up at noon on NPR News Presents, you'll hear the editor of Slate magazine, David Plotz, speaking with NPR's Eric Ringham at the NPR Broadcast Journalist Series event held last week. That's coming up after the Daily Circuit.
Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Department of Transportation, offering a reminder to do the zipper merge by resisting early merges using both lanes and following the signs. The correct, safe way to merge. More at dothezippermerge.org.
I'm Carrie Miller, and now we're in depth with Temple Grandin. Temple Grandin has been having her brain imaged for 20 years. As a scientist and an autism activist, she wanted to know about the neuroscience behind her autism. Now she's out with a new book about it, in which she predicts that the techniques doctors use to diagnose autism will one day be regarded as irrelevant and antiquated. We talked about why when she joined me at the Fitz before a sold-out crowd.
Well, the problem is their behavioral profiles. And in the autistic brain, Richard Panik and I reviewed the whole history of it. And it's kind of shocking how the behavioral profile kept changing. You know, the diagnosis of tuberculosis does not keep changing. You see, in the early 90s, they changed it to include the Asperger's with no speech delay. Now they're going to take out the Asperger's and call it social communication disorder, which is absolute rubbish. And it's not a precise diagnosis. And the social communication and awkward social stuff, that's probably the core, you know, criteria for autism. You know, in the future, you could probably diagnose all of this with brain scans,
right,
but you're going to break it up into component parts, like expressive language, problems with not getting language, meaning sensory problems, sound sensitivity, visual sensitivity, problems with the face recognition circuits, you know, much more specific things.
What do you think is the problem with trying to diagnose right now using the techniques that they have? I mean, what does that mean for the family or the child that gets the diagnosis?
Well, one of the reasons you have those diagnoses is for services and insurance payments.
Okay.
The problem that you've got with a DSM is about maybe half of it's based in science, and the other half is doctors squabbling around conference room tables in hotels. And the other problem you have with the autistic label is it's so broad. At one end of the spectrum, you've got a person that is going to remain nonverbal, be extremely handicapped, going to have to live in a supervised living situation. At the other end of the spectrum, you've got the Silicon Valley computer scientists. You've got Einstein, who didn't talk until age 3. Now, the one core criteria is the social awkwardness, but it's such a big spectrum, and it's very, very variable. And lots of times, teachers don't know what to do with the if they're working with the more severe kids, to do with a smart kind of Asperger kind of kid that's just getting bored in school and getting addicted to video games when he ought to be getting challenged.
So that's what happens then, is that no matter what traits of the autism that you're exhibiting, you tend to be treated or schooled in a similar way. There isn't enough nuance or difference.
Well, people just get locked into the label.
Okay.
I have parents coming to me and say, is my kid Asperger, autistic, or PDD, NOS, pervasive developmental disorder not otherwise specified? Well, they're going to take that out of the thing. Well, nobody's like saying, well, tuberculosis no longer exists. You know, this is the problem. And you've got such a big range. You know, so I'm seeing today on kids on the higher end of the spectrum with the autism label or Asperger's label not getting stretched enough.
Okay.
My mother had a very good sense of how to just push me slightly outside my comfort zone. When I was a young child, I served hors d'oeuvres at her dinner parties. She taught me how to shake hands. When I was 13, she got me a little job sewing dresses for a seamstress. You got to stretch these kids.
Do you think that's because parents, teachers, family members are afraid to push them to learn the kinds of skills?
You've got to stretch them. You can't throw them in the deep end of the pool, and you cannot have sudden surprises. That doesn't work. But when I was 15, the opportunity came to go to my aunt's ranch, and I was afraid to go. And my mother goes, you can go for a week or all summer. But she wasn't going to not let me go. One of the places where a line was drawn in the sand when I was in boarding school was I was not going to become a recluse in my room. Yes, and I wanted to work in the horse barn and not do very much studying. I allowed that because I was learning work skills, cleaning 8 horse stalls every day. But when I didn't want to go to the Friday night movie night, no, they weren't going to let me stay in my room for that. They made me the projectionist.
Clever. Very clever. You had a teacher at the boarding school who really understood you and helped you.
Well, I had a great science teacher, and this is where a teacher can really get a kid turned around. And the only places I was not teased and bullied were the specialized interests, like model rocket club, electronics, horseback riding. And I got interested in things like the optical illusion room and stuff like this. But then I wanted to become a scientist. But if I wanted to become a scientist, then I was going to have to study the things I was not interested in, things like English and history. And the last year I was there, I kind of pulled it together and really started studying, because now I had a reason to study.
When you were diagnosed, you say that one of the doctors, Dr. Crothers, at Boston's Children's Hospital said, she's an odd little girl, but your mother knew not to let a diagnosis or a we don't know quite what this is end there.
Well, first of all, the doctor that I went to originally when I was 2.5 was a neurologist, not a psychiatrist.
Mm-hmm.
And the neurologist didn't even know what autism was. This was only 4 years after the first paper on autism. Hadn't gotten over the neurology department.
Wow.
Yet. And I was, we referred my mother to a little speech therapy school that two teachers taught out of their home. And they used a lot of the techniques that are used today. You see, little autistic kids that are not talking, you've got to work with them lots of hours. When they're little, the treatment's the same for everybody. And my speech teacher would slow down and enunciate. She'd hold up a cup and she'd go, cup. And then she'd go, cuppa. Stretch out and enunciate those hard consonants so I could hear them. Also, lots of turn-taking games. Got to teach these kids how to take turns. That was taught to me with board games.
When you just said that when they're little, the treatment is the same.
Yes.
Why?
Well, they all look about the same when they're little. Now, the more milder Asperger's, or they're going to change it now to social communication, that's a kid with no speech delay. You know, and they show up in third or fourth grade and they don't have many friends. But where you have an early onset, they look very much the same. And as you work on them really hard, you know, lots and lots of hours of one-to-one teaching, you kind of have ones that kind of go more high-functioning.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have some where you can't pull them out and they're not going to be able to talk. But there are some that are completely nonverbal and look very, very, very handicapped and low-functioning that actually have a good brain inside. And in the book, in the autistic brain, profile Tito and Carly were too documented to be completely independent typing.
You decided to start having your brain scanned when?
Well, it was around in the late 80s when the very first MRIs became available. They were just barely available. And the first scan was done at Eric Corshane's lab, and they were looking at cerebellar vermis. That was not particularly interesting. Then a few years later, he did another scan, found that my cerebellum was about 20% smaller than normal, and that would explain some of the motor clumsiness and the fact that I could never learn how to ski and just keep them together. I could learn to ski, and I got to be a good intermediate, but I could never do that beautiful turns like that. And then as each new technology came out, I tried it out.
I know. It's really, I mean, you're a pioneer in brain imaging. The autistic brain.
Well, I call it journey to the center of my mind.
What have you found there at the center of your mind? That first time that you got into the MRI, I mean, these were the big, loud uncomfortable.
Well, I kind of felt like this going on the Starship Enterprise or something like that. I thought it was kind of cool.
Did you?
And the thing I thought was really cool is when I went in the control room and I saw my brain there on the computer screen.
What was that like?
It was like, wow, you know. And one of the things that showed up in that early scan that they just kind of poo-pooed off was my ventricles are asymmetrical.
I want to talk about what that means when you say the ventricles are
well,
different.
Basically the ventricles are little hollow areas inside the brain that are just full of water, cerebral spinal fluid. And normally they're in one place, but I had an extra long one, went back into the parietal area, which is involved with working memory and doing mathematics and sequencing, things I'm really bad at. And that would explain that problem. And it showed up on a scan done in 1988, and I noticed it on the scan.
You did.
And it was just it's nothing.
What would be the difference if you looked at someone's brain who is not autistic and your brain scan, and you looked in that area of the ventricles?
Well, one's much bigger than the other.
Okay.
It's very, very obvious when you look at it.
It is.
And there's you can go on the internet and look at some of the brain scans. The book's in black and white, so it doesn't really show them up. You just go on Google Pictures and type in Temple Grandin and brain scans.
Okay.
And you can find it. And the other there's an article in USA Today.
You're listening to a conversation at the Fitzgerald Theater with scientist and writer Temple Grandin. Her new book is called The Autistic Brain: Thinking Across the Spectrum. The abstract, the idea of thinking in an abstract way is difficult. And
well,
now you know why, right?
Well, when you say abstract, I actually saw an abstract painting that my mother had in the living room of the piano.
Huh.
And now I'm seeing the piano and trying to take piano lessons. That was not one of the things that worked out very well.
But that's the picture that came into your mind.
Abstract painting.
And that happens most times when people say a specific...
Abstracts are also summaries of scientific papers. So now I'm seeing some abstracts of different scientific papers. So if you want to see how I think, why don't you kind of treat me like I'm Google for images and give me some key words and be original, not house or car, and not something I can see here in this theater.
Okay.
Be original. And I'll tell you how my mind works in an associative manner.
I'm going to use the example that you used in the book, which is steeple.
Church steeple.
Church steeple.
Well, I see specific ones. But I was shocked to find out that some people just get this kind of vague thing like this.
Yeah.
I see specific ones. There is no generalized steeple. My concept of a steeple is based on lots of different steeples. And then I can start to associate off the subject. I remember reading an article about cell phone companies renting out church steeples. So this is how I can get from the subject of church steeples to cell phones. Now I'm seeing these like fake trees that they try to, you know, cell phone tower, they're trying to cover up what it is. So that's how I got from steeples to fake trees and
right.
cell phones.
But where I might see an abstract shape of a steeple.
I don't. There is no abstract shape. They're specific. We've got one church in Fort Collins that has a giant stainless steel cross for a steeple.
You see
now,
a lot
is that
of
a steeple? I don't know.
You see a lot of detail, though, in the steeple, right?
Yes, it's detail.
How do you arrest that process so you're able to focus? When your mind clicks...
I can stop it.
Okay,
I can
you
stop
can.
It, but there are some people that have difficulty stopping it.
How did you... That must have been a skill that you acquired.
Well, some of that is getting back to what they talk about teaching executive function, getting back to teaching little kids how to take turns and how to wait the turns. And that was taught to me with the Parcheesi board. You've got to wait your turn. You've got to shake the dice fairly. You've got to wait in line and wait your turn.
How hard was that for you to learn that?
It was hard. And this has to be taught. I don't care what the label is. You got little kids that seem to have problems. You've got to teach them how to take turns because there's problems with inhibiting. They've got to wait and take the turn.
That's hard for any little kid, actually, to learn.
But it's harder for autistic kids, and it's harder at a later age. Obviously,
right.
For 2-year-olds, it's hard. But for most 5-year-olds, it's not hard. You know, for some autistic 5-year-olds, it's hard to wait their turn, and board games are an excellent way to teach that.
You've also talked about learning to read social cues on people's faces?
Well, that has to be just taught. You know, like people roll their eyes and they're getting bored with what you're saying. If somebody's sitting like this, they're probably getting kind of resistant. I have to be taught those things. It's like coaching a person about the customs in another country. Where a gesture that's rude here wouldn't mean anything in another country. Some harmless gesture like showing the sole of my foot, that'd be rude over in the Middle East.
Right.
But I'd have no way of knowing that unless I was told about it.
That must have been hard.
Well, this is why you've got to just teach it. You just got to show a kid that shake hands. Okay, it's three shakes. You use this amount of pressure, not too light, not too hard. They've got to be just demonstrated, and they just have to be taught how to do it.
But facial cues and body language can be really subtle.
Well, and I've had a lot of problems with that. And when I was younger, I didn't even know these things existed because none of the books existed that are available today for teaching these things. And there's very good books and videos and things today for this, which did not exist when I was a child. When I was in my 40s, I thought everybody thought in pictures the way I did. I didn't know my thinking was really different. I learned about that by interviewing people about how they think. And I'm really, really into, you know, the different kinds of minds. Because kids that are labeled autistic, dyslexic, ADHD, I don't care what label gets slapped on them, they often have uneven skills. Good at one thing, bad at something else. And we got to work on developing the area of strength. My ability in art was always worked on being developed. I had to learn how to draw lots of different things. And the other thing that's really big, we have to teach work skills. And I think that needs to start around age 13. That's when mother arranged my very first job. Because you've got to learn the discipline of work. You know, when I went away to the special boarding school, for two years they just let me take care of the horse barn. Wasn't doing much studying, but boy, I was learning how to work.
Uh-huh.
And I'm seeing too many of these kids today, you know, with various labels, not learning the discipline of work. You got to do it every day, rain or shine. It's too cold. Your feet might be freezing or whatever. You still have to do it.
You tell this story in the book that when you make public appearances, parents will come up to you and say, you know, I've got an autistic son who cries because he gets so frustrated when he's working on the computer or he's playing a game or something. And your answer to that is, if I remember right, better that he's crying and not busting things
Absolutely.
Up.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And when I've talked to several retired NASA space scientists, and they told me that they were pretty sure that half the people at NASA probably were on the spectrum. And when... And when the shuttle was shut down, they were crying on 60 Minutes and walking off camera. Now, if they'd been throwing things, they wouldn't have had that job. And I actually got kicked out of school in ninth grade for fighting.
Did you?
Yeah. Throwing a book at a girl who teased me. I beamed her on the head with a big, heavy book. Threw it across the music room.
Oh, my gosh.
And then when I went to the boarding school, I got in some big fist fights. And they took horseback riding away for a week or two. And then I switched from anger to crying. I was still miserable when I was teased, but that saved me because I had a lot of social problems when working with the meat plants. Well, I'd go hide down in the electrical room or under the stairs, never in the restrooms because people would see me in there.
Huh.
And it's okay for geeks to cry. It's okay if boys cry because those boys are going to be able to get employment and keep it.
Temple Grandin telling us a little bit about her life and her ideas about neuroscience and the autistic brain. Back to the conversation that we had at the Fitzgerald Theater here in just a moment, but a look at the latest news. Hey, Tom.
Hi, Carrie. Officials say U.S. senators trying to resolve a key issue on immigration legislation have agreed to a compromise that covers the expansion of a high-tech visa program. The deal represents a compromise between the high-tech industry, which relies increasingly on skilled foreign workers, and organized labor. The agreement was negotiated by New York Democrat Chuck Schumer and Utah Republican Orrin Hatch and clears away one of the two major hurdles remaining as the Senate Judiciary Committee tries to complete work by tomorrow on the sweeping legislation. The CEO of Apple is disputing assertions by a Senate panel that the company avoids billions of dollars in U.S. taxes by shifting profits to foreign affiliates. Tim Cook testified at a hearing this morning by the Senate's Permanent Committee on Investigations, which released a damning report yesterday on Apple's tax practices. We pay all the taxes we owe, every single dollar, Cook said, saying that we don't depend on tax gimmicks, Cook took a defensive tone with his opening statement. He stressed that the 600,000 jobs the company supports and notes that Apple is the largest corporate taxpayer in the nation. More coming up here on The Daily Circuit.
Programming supported by St. Mary's University of Minnesota and their MA in Special Education program, offering teacher licensure preparation in emotional behavioral disorders. You can learn more at whysmu.com/SPED.
I'm Carrie Miller. Let's return to my Fitzgerald Theater conversation with scientist, professor, rancher, and writer Temple Grandin. Her new book is titled The Autistic Brain. She has spoken widely about her ability to think in pictures. In fact, she actually wrote a book about that. It's given her a unique perspective into the way animals think. And now she understands more of the brain science about why she's able to do that.
Animals don't think in words. Animals are going to be sensory-based thinkers. When they get afraid of something, it's a picture. I was just talking to Betsy Lerner, my agent, just last week, and she's got a little dog that's terrified of baseball hats because somebody did something bad to the dog when they're wearing a baseball hat. And if the person has a baseball hat on, they can't get near this dog. You take the baseball hat off, then it's okay.
How did you, I guess, discover or realize that animals are thinking in pictures?
Well, when I first started working with animals, I didn't know that my thought processes were different. And some of the very first work I ever did with cattle was to get down in the chutes, and I see that, well, the cattle were afraid of a shadow. They're afraid of a chain hanging down. They're afraid of a reflection on a fence. And I find if you take out these distractions, get rid of the truck that's parked next to the chute, then the cattle would walk right up the chute. And then, of course, I always get asked, are they scared of getting slaughtered? And I found they behave the same way at the slaughterhouse as they behave in the veterinary chute. They have the same exact behavior. And if you get rid of the things they're afraid of, like a chain hanging down or seeing people walking by, then they walk right up the chute.
What's your theory about why a swinging chain or somebody walking by would...
Well, they're very sensitive to rapid motion. See, cattle and sheep and all the grazing animals, they're prey species animal. They got wide-angle vision, so they're tuned in to looking for novel, rapid motion.
Okay. This is evolution, I assume.
So when they're grazing out on the plains, something moves rapidly. Well, it might be a wolf, it might be a coyote, it might be a predator out there.
Right.
And they're going to pay attention to that and watch it.
And the industry... I mean, now you are called in to consult on this a lot.
Well, I find in a lot of plants where the cattle won't go up the chute, I'm amazed at what I can do with cardboard and some portable lights. They
really?
Don't like to go into the dark, and they didn't like this lady that was checking cattle IDs, so I covered her up with a big piece of cardboard. and then I put a light on the entrance to the stunning area because it was dark, and they didn't want to go in the dark place. And that greatly improved how they moved.
There are probably some people in the audience that find this a little dissonant, that you love animals, you love cows, and that you work with the slaughterhouse industry.
Well, I've done a lot of thinking about that, and I can remember when I worked on designing my center track restrainer system, and I was standing on this big catwalk over just all kinds of cattle, and I thought, none of these cattle would have ever existed if we hadn't raised them. The cattle would have never existed at all. They would have never lived at all. And I feel very strongly we've got to give the farm animals we use for food a life worth living.
Mm-hmm.
I feel very strongly about that. And the slaughterhouses have gotten really quite good. In fact, we've got videos up on the internet. I've got a video up called Beef Plant Video Tour with Temple Grandin and a Pork Plant Video Tour with Temple Grandin. And that shows things really working right. And some of the problems I'm seeing now, I got to correct back at the farm. A dairy that lets their dairy cows get emaciated and weak and skinny before they sell them, problems with animals with too much muscle growth that are lame,
mm-hmm.
Animals that are super wild because they've never been handled by a person on foot. These problems have to be corrected back at the farm.
When we sat in on your class... You took some questions from students about why their cats were behaving in certain ways and why their dogs were doing things that they were doing. Do the theories that you bring to this pretty much apply across different animals, Or have you just acquired all of this individual knowledge about
individual examples? Now, all the animals are sensory-based thinkers.
Okay.
And when it comes to fear memories, animals tend to associate, when something bad happens, like let's say somebody beats a dog, for example, they tend to associate that with something they were either looking at or hearing right at the moment that the bad thing happened. It's a sensory-based fear memory. That's going to be universal, like the dog that's afraid of the baseball hats, for example. The other thing I find when you're trying to troubleshoot animal behavior is people are too abstract about it. They'll come up to me and they'll go, my dog is crazy. I'm serious. I'll be in a conference and they'll say my dog is crazy. I don't know what they mean by that. Did he bite somebody? Is it some little dog that's happy and it's jumping all over somebody? I don't know what crazy is. And I find the same problem troubleshooting problems with autistic kids.
I was going to say, yeah.
It's probably the same thing. They'll say, my kid has behavior problems in the classroom. I don't know what his age is. Can he talk? What is the problem? I can't even begin to answer that. I have to ask a lot more questions to get a lot more specific information.
Mm-hmm. And then do you find you're able to say to the parent?
Yeah, then I can answer it, but I've got to know. I don't know if it's a 3-year-old having a tantrum in nursery school, or is it a 6th grader that just doesn't want to do his homework. I don't know how many people say, tell me the most important thing about autism. Now, if the child is 3, I can say early intervention and lots of it, one-on-one teaching. But once I get past those real little kids, I've got to have a lot more specific information.
What do you make of the increased diagnosis rate?
Well, I think some of it's increased detection, because in the 90s, early 90s, they changed the DSM to where you no longer had to have speech delay in order to be autistic. You could then be the Asperger type, where you have the social awkwardness and social communication problem with no speech delay. So that probably accounts for some of the increase. You know, then you had the PDD-NOS, not otherwise specified, whatever that means. And then I think there is some severe autism that actually has increased.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the milder autism is increased detection, because I can think of people I went to school with that I know are on the spectrum.
What makes you say that?
Well, they were socially awkward. And they were just like the junior edition of this person that's come up to me at various autism meetings. And the thing that worries me is that old Asperger that's 40 and 50 has a job, has been keeping it. And part of the reason is they learned how to work when they were young and they had social rules pounded into them.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm seeing junior today not learning some of the most basic things.
So it sounds like you're saying that in your day and in the days when parents would just insist that kids learn those skills, today, even with more awareness of autism,
well,
there's less
happening,
insistence.
What's happening in the 50s, kids like me that were nonverbal and totally just sitting there rocking, they just put in institutions. But you take the child that's no speech delay, sort of more of the Asperger type of child, or now it's going to be changed to social communication disorder, and they're saying that's not autism, which is pure rubbish. Those kids that were on the milder end of the spectrum, they, you know, in the 50s and 60s, they just pounded the social rules into every kid.
Right.
And, you know, they were socially awkward, but they managed to get and keep jobs. And where a diagnosis really helped them was with their relationships and giving them knowledge about why they were having problems with their spouse. That was helpful. But I'm getting worried with some of these mild kids. They're getting held back. I talked to mom one time, and she said, oh, I have a son, and I'm pretty sure it was Asperger's, so it's never diagnosed. He's in his 35 years old, something like that. Got a really great job with a tech company, and he was just sort of, you know, weird Sammy. And I just hauled his butt up in the morning and made him get up, made him do things, and she said, do the right thing. I said, yes, you did. But I want to emphasize, no surprises. There are sensory problems that are real, legitimate problems. There are some individuals who can't tolerate the flicker of fluorescent lights. They can't tolerate loud noises and 5 TVs going on in a restaurant. And if there's one place where I think research really needs to be done, it's on sensory problems and how to treat them. They're really real, and you can have sensory problems with many labels, dyslexia, ADHD, autism, also head injuries also have the same sensory problems as developmental differences.
How do you feel about surprises today?
Well, they tend to cause panic. I mean, I'm better about
for
that
you?
Now. Well, I know if you have a thunderstorm at the airport, you're going to get stuck there. So that's not a surprise. you know, because I know what's going to happen. But you can't take these kids and just throw them into the deep end of the pool, you know, to kind of use a visual analogy, because they're going to just panic and drown. But you got to stretch them, and you got to stretch them just outside the comfort zone. I remember one time when I was about 18 and I was driving. I was afraid to go to the lumberyard myself to get the wood and things we needed to remodel the kitchen. I was very good at doing things like remodeling the kitchen. And Mother said, you're going to have to go yourself. And I was afraid to go in and talk to the clerks at the lumberyard. And
why?
I got upset. It just made me nervous to do it. But I went in and I came back really upset, but I had talked to the clerks in the lumberyard. There's a boss in the HBO movie who slams down the deodorant and says, you stink, use it. That actually happened. And you know what? Boy, I thanked that boss for that, and it did hurt some feelings. But those feelings needed to be hurt in order for me to develop. And that boss recognized my talent in drawing, because he'd seen some of my drawings, and that's why he hired me. But he said, if you want the job, you're going to have to clean yourself up. You can't be a slob.
You're listening to a conversation at the Fitzgerald Theater with scientist and writer Temple Grandin. Her new book is called The Autistic Brain, Thinking Across the Spectrum. Let's talk about the movie.
Okay.
You went to the set.
Oh, that was really, really fun.
What was that like?
Well, Claire Danes just became me in the 60s and the 70s. But I also went to the set because I had to make sure the dip fat was working right, because that equipment was real. And I was down there the night before making sure all the anti-drowning devices I had designed were welded on there right, and I was working with their welding crew.
And oh, my gosh.
That was like getting transported back to the 70s to that original job. But it was really wonderful.
So many people have seen the movie. What do you think is the result of that?
Well, on a lot of kids, I think it's motivating. I've gotten a lot of emails and letters from young children saying, yeah, I'm kind of a different kind of kid, but this has motivated me to succeed. And I love the fact that the movie showed all my work stuff. One of the things I had to learn, since I was weird, I had to sell my work. So I'd show my drawings off. And when I showed people my drawings, they took me seriously. Because the regular job interview, that doesn't work. You got to sell yourself by showing off your portfolio of your work.
So you would, I mean, you say this kind of offhandedly. I was weird, so it would be hard for you to get in the door if you weren't showing your work, because people just thought...
Well, I had to show my work, and the other thing I figured out very early on is certain people can open the door. Now, today, you can put your work on your phone.
Right.
And I remember going to an ag engineering meetings in the early 70s, and they wouldn't take me seriously until I pulled out my drawings. And when I pulled out my drawings, I go, oh, you did that? Well, then maybe we should be talking to you.
Do you find that, well, because of your activism, because of the movie and the additional knowledge out there about autism, that, you know, families can dream big? I mean, they can look at you and say...
Well, you see, another thing is, after you work with the little kids, they kind of go off into two different directions. The ones where they can do the things that I do, and then there's some that are not going to do the things that I do. They remain nonverbal. So there are a few that can learn to type independently. There are others that have all kinds of serious problems. They cannot do normal activities like go to a restaurant or a football game, which is very, very stressful for the family. You see, this is one of the problems in autism, is it's such a big spectrum. Now, when the kids are really small, they all kind of look the same.
Right.
But they almost kind of go into two groups. And the thing I find is teachers often have a hard time shifting gears. And the one thing I absolutely do not want to see is see a kid like me put into a classroom with a whole bunch of nonverbal kids. That I definitely do not want to see.
What do you do about an education system that's clearly struggling with that?
Well, the problem is that we're getting locked into the labels. And we need to be looking a lot more, what is this kid actually capable of doing? My drawing ability, that showed up around third or fourth grade. Kids that are good at math, that tends to show up around when they're 8 or 9 years old. Well, then if he can do the next grade of math book, let him do it. But the little math geniuses, they often need special ed and reading. That tends to be the pattern. Then you got kids that are good at words. We got to keep expanding things. He likes trains, read a book about trains. Let's do... mathematics with trains. We got to expand on those fixations. We got to get a lot more into what can they do when they grow up. And we've got to start teaching those job skills. And I think it needs to start around 13 years old. Let's just set up things in the informal economy, like walking dogs for the neighbors, fixing computers at some local businesses, making some PowerPoints for local, business people, maybe volunteering in a farmer's market. You know, and then when they're 16, then they can get more formal kinds of jobs. But they've got to learn how to work. Because and that's something that I had a lot of work experience by the time I graduated. And parents have got to work on setting that up.
Temple, do you think there's a lot more awareness of autism than when you were diagnosed with it and growing up?
But... Well, there is, and I get worried on the mild end of the spectrum with the labels holding them back. Now, I know you've got to have labels to get services, but I get concerned with these very mild Asperger type of kids. I'm seeing kids much milder than me that are sitting at home playing video games, and they're recluse in the basement, and they haven't learned any work skills. And this just drives me crazy, because then I go and I fly to Omaha or something, and I go out to meatpacking plant, and there's a guy in the maintenance shop that I know is on the spectrum, and he's 50, and he's had that job and survived 3 plant owners.
Huh.
This is the thing that makes me crazy, is I go back and forth between the cattle industry and autism, and I see all these people all over the cattle industry doing jobs like metal fabrication, guy that raises really nice Angus cattle, a guy that fixes a copier. They're all over everywhere, and they've managed to keep employment. And then Junior's hasn't learned how to work, and he's the same geek. And this really worries me. You know, like I know right now that 3M and other companies here are, you know, wanting more engineers. And then the tech companies are going to the government saying, well, we need more visas for engineers from China and India. I think we need to find out exactly what skills they're hiring from China and India. We got to train our Asperger kids to do a lot of those skills. But they've got to learn work skills. It's never too late to start.
You were named one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential people. Which is really something.
Well, I was very flattered by that.
For your work, I mean, you've made a big difference in the animal industry, and you've made a big difference in understanding autism. Are there people who say to you, why are you still working on the animal industry part of this, because you are a role model and you're recognized globally for the autism message?
Well, there's several reasons. First of all, I really like it. We just before this trip, I was down in Omaha and we were doing our PACO training. I'm a PACO instructor, Professional Animal Auditor Certification Organization. We had a class of about 30 students. We went and visited 2 plants and found I liked getting back out in the field again. And I wish I was doing more of that stuff. And I also, for another reason, autism is an important part of who I am. I'm a college professor first, and an animal scientist first, and autistic second. Because what worries me is I'm seeing too many kids where their whole hang-up is getting to be autism, and they're not developing. I'm not going to let autism completely take over. And they had to put the PACO training right in the middle of the book tour. And I said to Taryn Roeder, the publicist, you are not canceling PACO. And we are going to have to arrange this book tour around PACO. And my animal auditor training is right in the middle of the book tour. And they had to book a flight from Omaha to Minneapolis to get to here after PACO training got done. Kids come up to me and they go, they just want to tell me about their autism. I have a kid coming up to me telling me about his autism, and he's never done any work. And then he proceeded to tell me all these reasons why he couldn't work in a store. And I said, let's figure out a way to enable you to work in a store. And I said, well, you know, it's a small store, so maybe they can get a scanner. That's going to make it easier to do the cash register. Let's figure out how to do supports that enable. A wheelchair ramp enables the person in the wheelchair to go in that building and use that building. That enables. We've got to look at, okay, what would enable this person to work in the store. Let's figure out something we can do that would help them.
You don't feel defined by your autism, do you?
No, I don't. And I'm working on revising my livestock handling and trance book right now. Also, my genetics and the behavior of domestic animals book is coming out in June. And it's strictly an academic book. If it sells 1,000 copies, it's a bestseller for that kind of book. But I work really, really hard on that book. And we've got some really good animal behavior stuff in there because that is my profession.
It's Temple Grandin at the Fitzgerald Theater talking to us about her next writing projects. Hey, if you want to see video of Temple and me at the Fitzgerald Theater a week or so ago, you can find it on the Daily Circuit page. Check it out. And by the way, we broadcast our conversation with Isabel Allende. There's also video of my conversation with her, too. It's on the Daily Circuit page. Check that out. This is the Daily Circuit on Minnesota Public Radio News.
Support for this program comes from Allina Health. You can join Allina Health in packing healthy meals for neighbors in need Saturday morning, June 1st. More at neighborhoodhealthconnection.org.
You're listening to Minnesota Public Radio News, 91.1 KNOW, Minneapolis, St. Paul. Listen live with your free mobile apps available for Android and iPhone. The weather is 60. It's overcast in downtown St. Paul. We've got highs today in the upper 60s with a 50-50 chance of showers.